Our sermon text today is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verses 1 to 9, page 557 of your pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 8, 1 to 9. Who is like the wise, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. I say, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? Whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. For there is a time and a way for everything. Although man's trouble lies heavy on him, for he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. Title today is Discretion. And as I thought about this attribute, I thought of one of my favorite characters from World War II, General George Patton, for a number of reasons, although the title of our sermon was not one of them, Discretion, if you know anything about the biography of George Patton. He was brave, intelligent, aggressive, one of the best tactical commanders the United States Army has ever produced. He demonstrated this with his command in Italy at Sicily and Messina, where he showed courage, imagination, great skill in swiftly defeating forces larger than his own. But he was also loud, proud, and unable to curb his tongue. In one famous incident, he slapped a soldier who was in hospital for what we would now diagnose as battle fatigue. He cursed him, threw him out of the hospital tent, told him he was going back to the front. Was this a wise and discreet move, since he was being followed around by a flock of reporters at the time? Made headlines at home, and it hurt him, too. It hurt him with moms and dads who had sons in similar circumstances. This is representative of his short temper and his long diatribes that questioned not only the lineage and paternity of his enemies, but the wisdom of some of the decisions made by his superiors. When the Allies began planning the D-Day invasion of Europe, FDR and General Marshall and Winston Churchill considered many names, including Patton's, to be commander-in-chief, or to be supreme commander of the Allied forces, but all soon agreed that the volatile Patton, it didn't take long to make this decision, that he would soon polarize the command. And he also had a simmering feud with one of those generals, British Commander Montgomery. So in the best command decision of the war, in my mind, they decided upon General Dwight David Eisenhower to be supreme commander of the Allied forces. A very smart decision. And what they did with Patton was both brilliant and a bit of a sweet irony, too. They put him in command of a dummy, fictitious army in the south of England in Operation Quicksilver, it was called. It was meant to fool the Germans into thinking that the real invasion of Europe would come at the shortest crossing point in the English Channel between the Straits of Dover in England and the Pas de Calais in France, where there was a navigable harbor as well. Consequently, the Germans concentrated most of their forces there, built up this dense, impenetrable defense of the harbor. The real invasion, of course, would come at the more sparsely defended Normandy beachhead, as it did indeed June 6, 1944. The selection of Patton to lead this dummy army was a deft, two-edged sword. On the one hand, if the ruse was to have any credibility, it must be led by the general that the Germans feared the most, and that was George Patton. They had had enough of him in Italy. And on the other hand, it kept the stormy, impertinent Patton from sabotaging the plans for the real invasion at Normandy, which he probably would have done. He couldn't have helped himself. And historians generally agree that Eisenhower was the perfect man for the job. Patton would have been the worst. But you can imagine how the impetuous Patton felt about his new command. He had had visions of himself as an American Alexander the Great, who would sweep across Europe with his armies and into Berlin and beyond. He wanted to march on to Moscow, too, after Germany's defeat, since our armies were already there. Might as well, and these pesky Ruskies, as he called them, couldn't be trusted. To then be given command of rubber tanks and wooden guns in a dummy army, how humiliating. Now, it's not fit to print, it's not fit to repeat what he said to General Omar Bradley, who didn't like Patton and rather enjoyed delivering this news to him, when he was told of his new command. But we can cite some of his letters and journal entries. He says, in his journal, for instance, he says, well, I can't say at all. This blank secrecy thing is rather annoying, particularly as I doubt if it fools anyone, he says. He also says, on June 4th, 2 days before the invasion, all of us went to church. I am awfully restless and wish I were leading the assault. And then he writes to his wife, don't get excited when the whistle blows. I'm not on the opening kickoff. So, of course, Patton would go on to lead one of the most important actions of World War II, his bold and daring relief of the siege at Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge. And who knows what sort of leader he would have made. With a little more of the character trait exhorted upon us here in our text today, that is discretion. Discretion. His counterpart, General Eisenhower, who did have discretion, went on to become President of the United States, of course. Well, let's look at Solomon's exhortation of discretion to us, because he does it so very eloquently and compactly and savingly, I might add. From verse 1, then, you see in your outline, discretion. Discretion. The discreet man employs his gifts to their maximum when called upon, knowing their salutary effects. Now, our text begins with a proverb on the efficacy of wisdom in the life of a king's court. That's our setting for today. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. So the proverb set in poetry, in the essence of Hebrew poetry, is parallelism. Parallel thoughts, rather than rhyming words. We have rhyming thoughts, if you will. Two lines, generally. You have four lines here, two distinct thoughts. Two lines that reprise or perhaps advance a single thought. And we have that here. A rhetorical question asks, who is like the wise? And implicitly, no one. And who knows the interpretation of a thing? That's an excellent rendering of the Hebrew. The NIV has explanation of a thing. Interpretation is much better. The second line in this case advances the previous line, filling in the meaning or essence of wisdom. That is, it's given from God to interpret the world around him. What do you think a man would give for such an advisor? Especially if he had great responsibility over many peoples, as Pharaoh did. Consider the weighty, perplexing problems that face such men. Should I, Rehoboam, follow in the footsteps of my father Solomon and rule firmly but fairly, or increase their burden? Should I, Solomon, capriciously assign this baby to one of these two prostitutes? Or is there some way of discerning who is the true mother? Should I, Daniel, fall prey to the schemes of my enemies and pray to Darius the king for 30 days, or continue to pray to the only true God, as is my custom? True God, Yahweh Elohim, the true lion of the tribe of Judah. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? What would each of these men have given for true godly wisdom? Some of them had it, didn't they? Two of them did, at least, Solomon and Daniel. Should I, President Obama, persist in my... You knew I had to get to this somewhere in the message, right? Should I, President Obama, persist in my present course with the economy, knowing my policies have been a complete failure, making things worse, not better, or listen to other wisdom and change course? Should I, President Obama, persist in my present course in undermining our strongest ally in the Middle East, Israel, or listen to other advisors and support her, especially against Iran? Should I, President Obama, persist in my present course in listening to my radical feminist advisors and insist that the Roman Catholic Church violate her conscience on birth control in my new health plan? Or should I listen to other wisdom and scrap it? He hasn't asked me, though. What would this man give for true godly wisdom or an advisor with it? Have you noticed how gray and aged President Obama has become in these last 3 years? Take a picture of him when he took that oath of office and how he looks now. Have you noticed how stern and sad his visage is? And every time I see him, I now think of this text, the hardness of his face. The problems of the world are precisely as Koheleth describes them for us. That is, I said, I will be wise. Remember last chapter? I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it? The problems of the world always persist and escape solution, don't they? What is peace for all men? Where is it? Where is justice for all men? Where is prosperity and abundance for all men? And when you finally attain the rarefied air of absolute power as Solomon or Pharaoh or Obama, you finally grasp that brass ring of the accolades and the opportunity of all the people, and when you finally lay hands on the levers of power in America, what do you find? What do you find? Well, you find that you're not Messiah, after all. You find that you cannot simply translate your will and your wishes into reality at the wave of your hand or stroke of a pen like God. You find that despite your own self-flattering portrait as that of a deliverer, you've only managed to deliver disappointment and failure that perhaps Domino's Pizza can deliver better than you. All of this makes for hardness of face. That is precisely what Solomon is talking about. Oh, for wisdom that changes that expression. Who can provide it? How do you think the expressions on the faces of these men changed when advised by men of true biblical wisdom? Remember from our reading of the law this day? This proposal of Joseph's pleased Pharaoh. Oh, yes. You not only interpreted my dream, you provided a solution. How his face must have changed. Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Pharaoh says. Or how about Daniel when he says to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent this angel and shut the lions' mouths. Remember how fretful Darius was at the lip of the lion's den, wondering if his favorite advisor, Daniel, was still alive. Then the king was exceedingly glad, we read, exceedingly glad, and commanded that Daniel be taken up and out of the den. Or Nathan said to David, you are the man. You have struck down Uriah the Hittite and have taken his wife. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. How his face must have changed as well in a different way, I would submit to you. But one that was ultimately a relief as well. I guarantee you that the change of face noted here by Koheleth sounds like the voice of experience, doesn't it? The change of face noted here by Koheleth was experienced by Pharaoh, Darius, and David. Their faces shined. The interpretation of a thing offered by each of the godly wise was spot on. Joseph, Daniel, and Nathan were the wise ones sent by God to cut the Gordian knot, to slice through the bull, to make the face shine, to smile, rejoice, celebrates over a true answer. Such is the proverb then that opens this section. Let us then move on to verses 2 through 5. Oh, good. Our chiasm did make it into the bulletin. Thank you very much. Verses 2 through 5 comprise a chiasm for us. So you might want to reference that as we go through it. I'll be assuming that you are. Verses 2 through 5, point 2, discretion. The discreet man employs his gifts with restraint when under command, knowing his limited perspective. Oh, if Patton would have only learned this lesson, huh? The discreet man employs his gifts with restraint when under command, knowing his limited perspective. Koheleth now goes on to compactly describe the courtier's role in advising the king. Basically, he says, give it your best shot and then shut up and await the outcome. God will vindicate you. Give it your best shot and then shut up. So we can all go home now, right? That's the upshot of verses 2 through 5. My point does encompass verses 2 through 5, which in turn comprises a chiasm. A chiasm is, we've been through this before, but I'm just reviewing this for you quickly. A chiasm has parallel points which can be plotted on a type of graph, that is, on an X. Chiasm is the Greek word for the Greek word X, right? Letter X. So see your graph below in your bulletin. Note A and A prime there. In common, they have the keeping of the king's command, if you see that in your lap, right? They both advance the wisdom of doing so, both for the advisor who does and the advantage to the king and his people. A wise man should keep the king's command because of God's oath to him, that is, to the king. Do you observe the footnote in your text? All worthy translations should have a footnote there. There's a very close option to take, an objective or a subjective genitive. We've been through this before. Don't lose me now. Don't roll your eyes and examine your eyelids, the inside of your eyelids here for a moment, because you know what a genitive is. We went through this on Reformation Sunday, didn't we? Did we not? A brief example of a genitive would be the fear of the Lord. It could be taken as a subjective genitive where the fear is possessed by God and he fears us. Technically, linguistically, we could take that option. We could also take the other option, which is an objective genitive. That is, the fear of the Lord is the fear that we possess of him, right? Now, how do we know which is the right one? And they all said in unison, oh, amen. It hasn't been in vain. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Context determines meaning, doesn't it? And we saw that in Galatians chapter 2, when we wrestled with this on Reformation Sunday, that indeed the idea of the faith of Christ is also a genitive. Linguistically, technically, it could be either a subjective genitive, that is, we're talking about the faithfulness of Christ in performance for his people, or the faith of Christ that his people put in him for justification. And, of course, the context is an objective genitive, is it not? The preponderance of evidence is for the objective genitive, where our faith, Paul is talking about our faith that we reposit in Christ in order to be justified. And some have taken a different path on that, and we saw just how wrong that is, quite frankly. All right. We have an objective genitive here, though, after that digression. The options aren't as clear here, however. It could be an objective genitive. That is, it would be translated as your oath to God, an oath that a king or a subject would make to God. And as such, one would keep the king's orders or will be expressed as policy because of one's commitment to the word sworn unto God. Or it could be a subjective genitive. I suggest that that is what it is. Thus, it would be translated as God's oath to him. That is, an oath that God made to the king. And as such, one would keep the king's orders or will expressed as policy because of God's commitment to the king expressed in a promise or a covenant. And we know that that's the case with David and his descendants, is it not? From chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, So it's in this last sense in which I take this translation. It is a subjective genitive translated precisely as our text renders it. The motif of God's covenant with David determines this for me. I will raise up for you your offspring after you. I will establish his kingdom forever. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. The oath that God gave to David. Well, after all this, you are much better exegetes now, aren't you? And are better equipped and capable of interpreting texts for yourself, I hope. God gave an oath to David to establish his kingdom forever. The king who sat upon the throne was his true descendant. He was in every respect the Lord's anointed. As we observed in our Old Testament reading today, David was loath to raise his hand against his bitter sworn enemy Saul, precisely because Saul was nevertheless the Lord's anointed. So must he keep the king's command. In either case, there is an implied threat, however. You notice as well, whether it be the oath to the king or God's oath to him, the word of the king is supreme after all. Even as Eisenhower was the supreme commander of the Allied forces on D-Day, the king's word is supreme. He is the supreme commander. Then you note as well the following verse, 3. You see the B there is a euphemism for how we have rendered it, that be not hasty to go from his presence. That is, to excuse oneself in dismissal. Do not speak hastily in the king's presence. That is, to excuse oneself. That's the sense that we have here. And so you have a parallel with B prime as well. In verse 4, who may say to him, what are you doing? You all have your chiasms in your lap, so you're not completely lost and at sea on this, huh? You know what I'm talking about, I hope. Following with me? Both caution against rash speech and presumptive impertinent advice in the presence of the king when one is unaware or ill-informed. That's the sense here. The ESV renders this very accurately. What are you doing? What are you doing? We hear it echoed in the voices of Darius' advisors. O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? You can hear the tone, can't you? What are you doing? Darius. We hear it in the tone of the Jews before Pontius Pilate. If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. We have no king but Caesar, right? And Pilate wanted to let him go. You can hear the tone. What are you doing? Both of these examples embody the very essence of Solomon's caution. Do not take your stand in an evil cause. All of this sounds very much like the voice of experience, doesn't it, in Solomon's own life at court? How often do you think he heard this from his own advisors? The elders, the tribal chiefs. Solomon, what are you doing? Take that sword, cut that baby in half. Solomon, what are you doing? How many different ways can we say this? What are you doing? When I was a kid growing up, I thought that was my real first name. What are you doing, David? Here I come. Either that or no. I wasn't sure whether it was no David or what are you doing, David? As my real first name. What are you doing? 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 Captures in one expression the tendency in the human heart to question the judgment and the wisdom of anyone in authority, isn't it? As a young believer, I questioned the judgment of the deacons of the little Baptist church I attended. We had a food pantry from which we supplied the needs of our congregation and the needs of our community. One of the requirements the deacons laid upon petitioners for our food or assistance of any kind was that they attend a worship service of the church. As a young idealistic Christian, I thought that all of this was unnecessarily strict, quite non-compassionate. After all, Jesus didn't require that all those 5,000 people he fed attend a synagogue service, did he? I said that to one of the deacons. I wish I could take those words back now. Can you hear the, what are you doing? Of course, later I discovered that there were those in our community, Grand Rapids, Michigan, 800,000 now, up to about a million, with hundreds of churches. These people systematically eked out a living by cynically making a case of need to local churches. They're getting money, food, and clothing. They could move on to easier prey by ignoring the requirements of churches like us. I had neither the wisdom, the experience, nor all the information either to make a sound judgment. But that didn't stop me anyway. What are you doing? And since being a pastor and participating in the decisions made by session, by extension, presbytery, I have a great deal more sympathy for those deacons, too. We often have information, the congregation or maybe the presbytery has information that others are not privy to, the congregation in general, nor should they be. And hopefully, session has a measure of godly wisdom and experience that lead us to sound decisions. That's the theory. And this is why Reformed and Presbyterian congregations elect elders, and why, after having done so, the congregation should trust the decisions made by those bodies and not exclaim, "What are you doing?" There's a caveat here, though. We are Presbyterians, and so it doesn't mean you can't respectfully ask questions or even challenge a decision if there is something egregiously illegal, immoral, or unjust about them. There is the Presbyterian court system. So the caution put before us by Koheleth is against my previous attitude, that is, impertinent, arrogant, and presumptive questioning of a ruling body's or a ruler's wisdom and judgment in making a decision. The prudent man will be discreet in his judgments when he is not privy to all the information and the course taken in making decisions. General Patton surely wasn't privy to the counsels of FDR, Churchill, and General Marshall when they appointed the judicious, discreet Eisenhower as supreme commander of Allied forces. Nor was he privy to the information and the counsels when Eisenhower and Bradley made Patton commander of a cardboard and rubber army. Patton chafed, and he complained privately, and he flirted with insubordination on several occasions, almost charged with insubordination on several occasions. But in the end, Operation Quicksilver is considered one of the most stupendous successes in military history. Following, by the way, Sun Tzu's principle that clever deception is worth a company of soldiers. So Koheleth's advice to those of us who must live with decisions we may not like or agree, what is it? Well, he says the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. The wise heart will know the proper time and the just way, does he not? That brings us to point 3, verses 6 through 9. Discretion. The discreet man employs his gifts with humility while serving the king, knowing that timing is everything. Oh, we see this theme again, don't we? Timing is everything. There is an aptness to everything. Do you observe how Koheleth now comes round again to a motif enunciated in chapter 3, verse 1? He's doing this again, isn't he? He's coming back to themes. He'll put this one aside, but he'll come back to it again later in the book. There's a time and a way for everything. Everything, there's a season. Remember from chapter 3? A time for every matter under heaven. The wise man knows the apt time to do a thing and the fit method for doing it. There's an apt time and a fit method. He knows the time to hit the nail is not when his thumb is on the head centering the nail, and he doesn't drive a picture hanging nail with a sledgehammer, does he? I almost did that the other day. He knows the time to say, "Be careful on the black ice, honey," to his wife. It's not when she's lying on her back in the leather high heels he's encouraged her to wear, no. He knows the time to say, "Use the red pump head, not the green pump head," to his young son filling the gas tank for the first time. It's not after he's just filled up the family Buick with diesel fuel, is it? There's an apt time and a fit method for doing a thing. And the wise counselor, the wise king, knows the apt time and the fit method. The time to say, oops, there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is not after you've committed the 4th Infantry Division to Baghdad, is it? Now, we can debate whether we really knew or not whether there were weapons of mass destruction. The time to say we should stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon is not after a mushroom cloud blossoms over Tel Aviv in Israel, but before, with a judicious use of both military and non-military methods, right? These are issues kings wrestle with, but we wrestle with these kinds of issues too. The foolish boss, I know none of you have experienced any of these are some things from my past. The foolish boss who chews out a subordinate in front of the very people he expects the subordinate to command, huh? Or the wise boss who takes his subordinate aside in private and corrects him in the manner that he knows will be the best for improving this man's performance. Or how about the foolish engineer who tells his superiors, this system will not bear the stresses to which you're subjecting it after radioactive material is spewing into the atmosphere, knowing full well that this was the state of things beforehand? Or the wise engineer who follows the chain of command, puts everything in writing, and alerts his peers to every contingency? Or the foolish employee who criticizes management at every opportunity around the water cooler, the lunchroom, and the parking lot? Or the wise employee who uses proper channels and chains of command to make intelligent, helpful corrections and suggestions for improved performance? The same goes for the life of the church as well. Life in the church. It ought to especially apply here. Discretion. Do you know how to deal wisely with your session? Do you know how to deal wisely with your pastor? Just a footnote there. If you want good information on how to handle your pastor, ask the expert over here. She is a woman of discretion, and I thank God for her. How about this? Does your pastor know how to deal wisely with his officers? Does your pastor know how to deal wisely with his flock? Don't answer all at once, okay? I know very well that I have failed in many respects in this regard, in being discreet and wise in my full performance of my responsibilities and duties. I'm painfully aware of this. This is why I say I have to preach in the mirror oftentimes as well every week. Well, the wise man does all of these things in keeping with our motif from last week. A man has got to know his limitations, right? What text was that from? Anyway, a man has got to know his limitations. And Koheleth goes through this a little bit with us. He does not know what is to be. No man has power to retain the spirit that is at death. There's no discharge from war. How many tours have many of our vets undergone, huh? We know this full well. There's no discharge from war. Nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. The idea that one can save oneself, survive, thrive, and prosper in wickedness. Lo, we have made a pact with death. The prophets railed against those who did so. And here Solomon is subtly pointing then to the one who reigns above the sun, right? He's talking about life as we experience and know it under the sun, but constantly at juncture after juncture, we see him pointing very subtly, carefully to that land above the sun, to the sovereign God who holds all things in his hand. He will dispose and dispense the destiny of his creatures in his own providential time. He is the ultimate in aptness, if you will. And he'll do it in his own ways, by his own methods. He is the ultimate in mode and method, is he not? And the wise man will realize this. He will do that which is within his power. That's the idea of doing the best you can. And await the deliverance of the Lord. Await the deliverance of the Lord. Then, while the people eagerly anticipated Solomon to be the promised king who would reign perpetually from the throne of David, Koheleth, by this time, humbly realizes he's not that man. He is but a sinner in need of salvation himself. He's fallen prey to horses and women, hasn't he? it was left to another, a true son of David, not Solomon's direct descendants, but a true son of David nevertheless, to know the times and the seasons, the apt day of silence, as a lamb led to the slaughter, Isaiah puts it, but also the apt day of proclamation. I heard a loud voice from the throne say, behold, the dwelling place of God is now with man. Also knew the apt day of submission to his Father and the apt day of power. As Revelation says, worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. Dear listener, Revelation, this is a declaration of the present rule of Christ, the present rule of this king, to which all of the Old Testament saints eagerly searched and looked. The scriptures ransacked the lives of the Solomon and the kings to discover if, might this not be the one? But they were not, were they? But it was this one. He has now taken the scroll. That scroll in Revelation, as we have seen, was the covenant deed to his kingdom. He's the one able to break those seals, and he now rules. He is taking charge of his inheritance, even now in your lives, dear brothers and sisters. This would be an apt time to come to him, if you have not already. Make a profession of faith in this one before this congregation. That would be a proper method as well for coming to this one. This is also an apt covenant moment to share then a communion meal with him as well. An apt time and a proper method to participate in his body and blood as we take the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord this day.